Hi, Anne. I am, for the viewers out there, I am Timothy Noah, a senior writer at Slate Magazine.
Well, it's great to have you on Blogging Heads. I'm Anne Althaus at the University of Wisconsin Law School and the blog Althaus.
And we are both, Blogging Heads veterans, but this is our first pairing.
That's true.
Our first historic
and
pairing.
Where are you located?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm in a newsier place, I feel. I'm in Madison, Wisconsin.
You are in the revolution. You are in the white hot center of the counter revolution. I believe we call that the counter revolution. and I'd love to start just by asking you about what you've been out and about in the Capitol, and I know you've been blogging extensively about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been going on for 2 weeks now from this point of view. So, you know, ever since the first little demonstration on the two Sundays ago, we've been out there. I've been out there almost every day. My husband, Mead, has been out there even more than I have. So we were getting a lot of videos, getting a lot of photographs, talking to people, seeing what it's really like at the revolution.
So what's,
what I saw at the revolution.
What's happening at the revolution? First, I want to. I would like to endorse the conservative view that this really is not a lot like. What's going on in the Middle East? The Middle East, people are rising to protest their government. In Wisconsin, the people who are protesting, my understanding is largely, are people who work for the government, which I think is an important distinction.
Well, they're people who work for the government, but they have a structural, political, economic relationship with the Democratic Party, which was just defeated in the last election. Now they're here in the Capitol protesting, banging their drums hours on end, and one of their favorite chants is, "This is what democracy looks like," which I think is a weird thing to say since they just lost the election. Scott Walker and the GOP in the legislature here just got sworn in last month.
The other important difference with the Middle East, I wanted to say, is that in the Middle East, those guys who were protesting in the Middle East seem to know how to get a raise for government workers. Colonel Gaddafi has just announced that everybody gets a raise, and we've seen that actually in several of the countries that. That's another.
It's a good thing that it's cheaper to give people a raise than to kill them. I mean. I think he's only giving them $400. It's got to cost. This is gallows humor, but I mean, why not do things with money if you have that much money? If you see yourself going down, why not mobilize all your money and do what you can with it? Now, on the other hand, here in America, we're not on the verge of a revolution, and it's very weird to see things compared to the Middle East. I mean, I have seen. People here do think that this is like Egypt, or if we just hang on for 18 days, then we could overturn, you know, our dictator. And we see all these signs that say, you know, Hitler, Stalin, Walker, portraying Scott Walker. And funnily enough, it's just within 1 month of the whole civility, let's all have civility after the Tucson massacre. It's 1 month after that, and suddenly our governor here is Hitler, and he's on a list with Hitler and Stalin. He's portrayed with a Hitler mustache. The exaggerated rhetoric is, you know, unbelievable.
Well, let's both go on the record. Scott Walker is not as bad as Hitler or Stalin.
Right, and the democracy in Wisconsin is not as flawed as the democracy in Egypt and Libya.
Right. He's not even as bad as that other son of Wisconsin, Joe McCarthy. I'll even go that far.
Did you see him on Meet the Press yesterday?
Joe McCarthy was on Meet the Press yesterday?
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool? Meet the Press of the dead.
I didn't see Walker on Meet the Press.
I mean, he isn't a big charismatic type political leader. He's like the earnest accountant, the Boy Scout, who's just stepped up to the job of dealing with this horrendous budget problem. And he's just doing the hard work. You know, he's the county executive in Milwaukee for years, and he's just trying to make things work, trying to work things out. I mean, that's the image that from the point of view of our revolutionaries, he's a puppet of the Koch brothers and all of this stuff. But really, if you see him, he just seems like a very modest, earnest person.
Well, why can't he be a modest, earnest person and a puppet of the Koch brothers?
A modest, earnest, well, yeah.
taking money away from taking money away from workers in Wisconsin and instead giving it to ballet dancers at the New York State Theater former New York State Theater in New York.
It needs to be established that I am one of those workers. I am a state employee.
You are a state employee. Yes.
The plan is going to cost me over $10,000 a year. So I am facing, you know, I have skin in the game.
You have so you're going to cost you what? That's like about a 16th of your salary, something like that.
well, we have to start paying 5.8% of our salary into our pension plan instead of what's been 0.2%. So we,
and is that that figures into you? That's where the 10,000 is. No, that's not where the 10,000.
And then having to pay more for our health insurance. We have great health insurance, which we pay almost nothing for. Basically, it's a compensation package where benefits are a big part of what we have, and that's the way public employee salaries pay is going to be structured. You know, it's a way of hiding it from the taxpayers. It's a way of making it look bad, less bad than it is. You know, our salaries are up online. You could look up my salary online, and you may think it's high.
That's why I said that.
Right, you don't realize how much higher it really is if you view the real pay package rather than the salary standing alone. Much of our pay as public employees is structured into something that doesn't look as bad, and it's also structured in such a way to push it down the road so that you get compensation later after you retire.
But
taxpayers don't necessarily see that, you know.
Those changes are already enacted, right? Those changes were enacted without anybody having to take away the right, the union's right to bargain collectively over non-wage issues. Is that right?
No, these are changes that are being put through now. And also there's lots of local government.
Wait, those are the changes these are not the concessions that were made before.
I'm not in the union. I'm a law school professor. But the people in the union officials have said that they would concede that they would make those concessions with respect to insurance and pension plans. But that's just the leaders of the union saying something. As Scott Walker was saying on Meet the Press yesterday, there are all of these local government contracts that have to be bargained for with the teachers. They have this collective bargaining power that he's trying to reduce to just being a salary and not to these other things. And at the local level, they're not bound by just an assertion that's been made by the union officials. And even during this period when it's all in dispute, they are bargaining for contracts and they're asking for things that would go beyond these concessions. So there's nothing that locks in those concessions. That's just a statement that's being made. And what Walker's trying to do is get this flexibility so he can work with the within the budget and deal with problems without having to lay off people, which is what he had to do as the Milwaukee County executive. So a lot of this is about not laying off people, and I think some of it is about protecting teachers, seniority and, you know, who gets fired, who gets laid off when they have to lay people off. And it gives the government more flexibility in trying to deal with what is genuinely a terrible budget crunch. It's not as bad as in Wisconsin as elsewhere, but we're trying to deal with it. And, you know, our pensions depend on it. So, I mean, we are all, we have a lot at stake.
So let's talk about the union for a second. You are not a member of the union, and that's, I thought it was a closed shop. Does the union not extend to
the
university?
The university? The professors are not. There are some groups that work for us, but I'm not a union member.
But in effect, what they agree to ends up affecting you with respect to healthcare. And I mean, you were saying that you are going to you will be affected by this decision, right? So at some level,
we're the state university, so we're not working with local government. But you know, I'm not an administrator, so I don't know the details of how the budget gets approved within the university and the law school and so on. But that's the proposal. You know, there's also a proposal to split the University of Wisconsin-Madison out of the rest of the University of Wisconsin system, which is huge. And our chancellor is working, I think, with the governor to do something that would give us flexibility as the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You know, we have this world-class research institution here in Madison, and then we have all the branches around the state of the University of Wisconsin system, and it's been kept as one whole, and our chancellor here is working to separate University of Wisconsin Madison from the rest of it. So the whole structure of how these deals will be made is in flux right now, and people are, you know, people are maneuvering in ways that I can't really see and can't accurately talk about. But people want flexibility. You know, there are people who think they will benefit or they'll be able to do good things if they get flexibility. And there are people, obviously, who fear the flexibility and think that they'll be the losers. Even within the teachers union, I'm sure there's some teachers who think they would benefit if things were decalcified, if the structure of things were changed, if there were merit judgments of teachers and people were dealt with in different ways rather than, well, I mean, it's the same issue you always have with unions. Should everybody get together and be treated as a whole, or do you think that you would do better interacting with your employer independently? Some would, some wouldn't.
Well, let's talk about the larger agenda here, which is, I mean, I just got done reading a piece in the Weekly Standard. Has actually a pretty interesting piece about this that I just got done reading by Daniel DeSalvo. Then I read a piece by Rick Hertzberg in The New Yorker, and it's interesting. They both the pieces are strikingly similar in a lot of ways. They both say, look, this isn't about the budget. This is about crushing the political power of the public employee union, which is a vital part of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, and public employee unions across the country are a vital part of the National Democratic Party. And that's
political
what the agenda,
rhetoric,
that's what the agenda is here.
That's the Democratic Party rhetoric that you're reading. Well, you're saying it's also
well,
the
Democratic
Standard.
Party rhetoric in the Weekly Standard by Daniel DeSalvo.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that one.
The difference between what DeSalvo says and what Rick Hertzberg says is that DeSalvo says, you know, damn right, this is about busting union's power in
is that
in
a quote or a paraphrase? Is that a quote or a paraphrase? Because I would think that the Weekly Standard view, and I haven't read that article, would be something more like saying that the unions have been crushing the public's budget and the structure of the economy in the state in such a way that is in a kind of an unholy alliance with the Democratic Party to the detriment of the taxpayers, and the crushing force of the union is what needs to be removed from the throat of the taxpayer, something like that. I mean,
well,
but
let me
long-term political party power structures and the future of the Democratic Party and the future, obviously, too, of the Republican Party is at stake. There's a lot that's going on here because the interaction between the public employees union and the Democratic Party is quite extreme. I don't want to say it's corrupt, but you can see how people get what they want from one party. They increase their numbers. They continue to give money and support and get out the vote for that party. When that party gets in, it gives something more. And at some point, it's unsustainable. So the idea that you need to break that dynamic and do something about that because it's not a sustainable way to run a state economy. That makes sense to me. But I'm not an economist or a political scientist that's into the whole political economic structure of the way American politics work. But I think there's something really going on there that we need to pay attention to.
Well, let me just read you a little bit what DeSalvo says. He says, we come to where the rubber meets the road, the money unions spend on politicking. This money mm-hmm. originates with taxpayers who pay public employee salaries, a portion of which is deducted in the form of union dues and then used by the unions to support almost exclusively the Democratic Party. The public, in effect, subsidizes a powerful demand for bigger government and higher taxes. Although,
I'm
not sure I buy the idea that it's the public's money once it's in the pocket of a worker. But is the money you spend to buy a car?
There's a flow of money that goes through government. Government takes our money in from taxpayers, takes some people's money more than others. Mm-hmm. People who are productive out there in the economy, they make more money. Their money is raked into a pile and then it's channeled back out. Now, if it's channeled back out through this kind of, cycle that has to do with the Democratic Party and the unions, then of course taxpayers should be very concerned that their money is going into that cycle and being used to boost the party that is putting more money into public employment and taking money out of private enterprise. I think there is something unsustainable about that that people need to be alerted to. I think
why aren't public employees, if that's true, why aren't public employees fantastically wealthy right now?
Because there just isn't, there's never enough money for all of that. And also because obviously they are good jobs. I mean, one thing that to me is interesting is to see this sort of rhetoric of the kind of unions that came out of the Industrial Revolution when people genuinely were crushed with poverty and had terrible living conditions and so forth, that you now have that rhetoric about I'm sticking to the union, all that sort of thing, being chanted and urged with great passion by people who have excellent jobs and excellent benefits.
Well, will they have excellent jobs and excellent benefits once they lose their right to collective bargaining? I think that's the question.
I think they will have better jobs because the long-term health of the economy will be preserved, and especially our pensions. The greatest thing about the public jobs that we have is that we have excellent pensions and that we have an excellent healthcare system here that we're hoping to benefit from as we get older. We put in a lot of time. I've worked for the state of Wisconsin for more than 25 years. We put in a lot of time building up something that is a great benefit to us in the future. And the future health of the economy of Wisconsin is hugely important to those of us who've been devoting our life's work to teaching and the other things that we do in public service in the state of Wisconsin.
Would you be in favor of seeing the union entirely crushed?
I think crushed is an inflammatory word.
Destroyed. To see it no longer exist. I mean, one of the provisions in this bill, as I understand it, is that the union has to get recertified every year, right?
Well, I think there is a question. I think, there's a problem of a lack of competition. For one thing, public employees, it's really a monopoly. The government is a monopoly. So you have unionized people who are working for the people of the state, and we don't have any choice to go get our police or our fire protection or our teachers somewhere else. I mean, we could go to private schools or whatever, but basically, we're in a stranglehold, and the union has worked this system in a way that is advantageous in some ways, but not others. And, if they have to get re-elected every year, they have to prove their worth. And it may be that there are a lot of people who would rather not pay union dues if their employer is treating them better. If they don't like what the union officials are doing, they might not agree with the union officials' politics. They might not like to see those people getting rich. And, the union runs a healthcare program that apparently costs the workers an extra $600 million a year because they can't get into because they're going through the teachers, through the union health plan rather than the state health plan. So there are a lot of things like that where there could be a cost savings. You actually could maybe get a better deal out of the employer, the state. And it's possible that you would prefer not to have the union. Now, the fact that you could go back to the union puts pressure on the employer to treat you better so that you won't want the union. So there's a kind of bargaining in the shadow of the possibility of unions. And then the unions have to perform better.
That's not the way it works in the private sector, though. I mean, the private sector, you don't maintain your leverage when you're non-union employees at Walmart.
Well, there are a lot of companies.
Theoretically, they might be able to start a union at some point.
Well, what about the car company? I mean, there are a lot of companies that aren't unionized, and the lack of pressure to unionize is that they're getting treatment that they prefer. And the employer knows that if they weren't treating their employees well enough, the pressure would build. The union would have power to organize. There's a dynamic there. It's a market.
So are you saying there's no economic difference between being unionized and not being unionized?
I'm saying that the potential to unionize creates an incentive on the employer to reach a certain standard that would disincentivize the workers to want to be in the union.
But it's still a baseline fact that you're going to make more money if your workforce is unionized than if the union is some theoretical proposition.
Are you saying that about public employees or private employees? Because
I think it's true of all unions, public and private.
Public and private have got to be separated for analyzing.
Well, let's talk about public employee unions.
There's no market.
How can you not make more money when?
Okay, let's say you have two car companies. You have two car companies, and one is unionized and one isn't. Mm-hmm. Right, Toyota, or what, the workers who make Toyotas aren't unionized, correct? But the workers who make a GM
cars. Wait, I thought we were sticking to the public model here.
Well, I'm just saying you need to treat them separately. If you have a competition in private industry, it might be that you're better off as a worker in the ununionized company. Obviously, there's potential. That, I mean, there are rights to unionize, so you're not pursuing that path because you're happy with what you have compared to what you think you would have with the union. So there's a market in both. People can buy different cars, and in people can either be unionized or not. In the public sector, there's no market in the product. The public is stuck with the product that the government is putting it out, although we operate through democracy to produce different behavior from the employer. But if the employer is tied to the union, it can't respond to the public as well. So there's a kind of a dysfunction in the market. Well, there's not a dysfunction, or there is. There's something different about the public sector. I don't mean to be terribly sophisticated about talking about that, because I'm not. I think that we need to see that people might be better off. People will decide, we'll vote. People will vote for or against unionization, and you will see what they choose. And maybe the state will treat them in such a way that they will prefer not to have a union. Or the union will earn its keep, and people will vote for it.
Why would the government pay them more money without a union? Why would it want to do that?
To keep people from choosing the union as an alternative.
There's a market there, right? But it's
part of the market.
It certainly doesn't eliminate the advantage that you have as a union worker. You're always going to make more money as a union member than you are as a non-union member who has this vague threat that you can pose that you might organize a union, which is a very sort of difficult, cumbersome process.
I think you're just stating something as an article of faith, and I'm not willing to join the religion.
Well, just in general, I mean, there's statistics show that union members tend to make more money than everybody else, right? I mean, they tend to make more money than non-union members.
I think maybe not every last union member. I think there's a dynamic there that's more complex than that, and I'm not willing to accept that as a pat, assumption that is a fixed point. I don't think it's a. What about all your deferred union benefits go into a pension plan and the state goes bust? What good is that? Also, what Scott Walker has been saying is he's going to have to start laying off teachers. Well, who's going to be laid off? The union has a seniority system, so the new people, the young people, will be laid off. Not the worst people, but the youngest people, and people will be laid off to preserve something has to give somewhere. If you want to say, where will the most people be better off? I think it's a very complex system, and that you can't have pat assumptions there. You have to look at the reality.
Well, I will concede that obviously unions are not perfect, particularly their rigidity on questions of seniority have posed a problem.
Especially when you're
reform.
In education, isn't the most important thing the children, educating the children?
Isn't the most important thing educating the children? Absolutely. A lot of people would argue that the teachers' unions have to some extent been forces for education reform. Albert Shanker, who was a leader of the
do you think the teachers' union puts the interests of the children first?
I think sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. I'm pretty skeptical about the centrality of teachers' unions to the problem in U.S. education. I think, for one thing, I think that if labor friendliness were the key factor, then we wouldn't be getting our asses kicked around the world by many countries that have much more labor-friendly governments, where the teachers' unions are much stronger. United States, I think that's true, isn't it? I mean, don't you have basically the sort of best-performing education systems tend to be in those areas where the teachers are more likely to have a strong union?
I think there is a positive
correlation. I'm just saying I'm not sure I believe in the negative correlation.
No, I don't believe.
Probably
well,
zero
but there
correlation.
Is the one thing I'm trying to call attention to is that the union is going to be interested in protecting the teachers' jobs, especially in a seniority system that isn't vulnerable to merit judgments where people get disparate pay based on merit and so forth, then the firing, the laying off is done according to seniority. So you lose some flexibility about the quality of the teacher. Very hard to get rid of bad teachers and so forth. I think
the union is a force. I understand that, and I am an advocate for reform of many practices as conducted by teachers unions. My sense is that I have to say as a reporter who's been covering domestic policy for 30 years now. Mm-hmm. It seems to me one of the things I've been reading about is about teachers unions making concession after concession over the years a lot of these issues, and we still haven't seen much in the way of improvement. So that I have to say that has eroded my faith in.
I think the
centrality of the labor issue here.
Well, I think the quality of it. Why are American students worse than students in some of these other countries? I think American culture is very different. I think we have to go beyond the schools themselves there.
I don't know what the answer is. It's very dispiriting. Which we actually this
just not as interesting. We don't stress math and science the way we should.
Right.
And the teachers, I do think some of it is, if you look at the teachers, they're not as interested in math and science. Who goes into education these days? It's not the people who are, math and science are not sufficiently stressed in American schools. There's all of this reading of stories and activities of all sorts. They waste the kids' time an awful lot. I mean, I'm pretty critical of school. I mean, we force children to go to school. We imprison them all day long in school. And what do we really give them? I don't think we give them enough to justify the physical and mental restrictions we impose on their entire childhoods.
Well, this gives us a good transition into the subject of Tyler Cowen's new book. Have you read this book, The Great Stagnation?
No.
It's being sold as an ebook. It's really an essay. Well, I wrote about it last.
You like it?
Pardon me?
So what did you think of it?
I thought it was a very interesting book. I think it was I'm wary of it because I'm wary of large sweeping generalizations about the kind of direction of the economy. They have a funny way of being wrong. And I began my piece by citing the work of a couple of friends of mine, actually, from the Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau, where I used to work, Bob Davis and David Wessel, who are, as I said the piece, I think probably two of the best, possibly the two very best business reporters working in newspapers today. They wrote a book in the late 90s that's actually still a very good book, still well worth reading. About kind of the long-term trends in the economy. But when I tell you the title of this book, you are going to wince. It was called Prosperity, the Coming 20-Year Whatever. I mean, they were completely wrong about that. They were arguing in the book that the long stagnation of middle incomes was a right about to end because the computer revolution was going to lift all boats, and it didn't happen. And another one of their predictions was that the educational system was about to revitalize itself. There was a falling off in the 70s, and there's been a kind of leveling off since then in high school graduation rates. But there was a slight uptick that they were observing in college enrollments that was attributable to the increase in community colleges. And they said they kind of extrapolated from that and said, community colleges are going to retrain our workforce and revitalize the middle class. What's basically happened since 1998 when that book came out was the community college enrollment has stayed level. Community college graduation rates have been sort of dismally low. The graduation rates of for-profit universities, which sort of stepped in and the 90s and the aughts to try and fill that gap? Have even lower graduation rates? So there really hasn't been any improvement. So that's in that context. I was looking at this Tyler Cowen book where he argues sort of the opposite, where Davis and Wessel were arguing, prosperity is right around the corner. Cowen basically says, we have plucked all the low-hanging fruit. That's the sort of governing metaphor of his essay. He said, all of these huge increases in economic growth that we enjoyed through much of the 20th century, that came from us plucking low-hanging fruit. At the turn of the century, only 6% of Americans graduated from high school. And, now the percentage is, about 75% or something. And, when you've got that huge pool of untapped potential, you're going to have more economic growth than when that talent pool is shrunken and you're dealing with kind of some of the hardest cases, very low income kids, growing up in troubled homes and so forth. It's an interesting argument. And he makes a similar argument about innovation. He says that, there is, I think, some truth to what he argues about innovation. So people tend to swoon over the computer revolution, but it was, in fact, a bit of a yawn compared to the advent of electricity, widespread use of electricity at the start of the 20th century. He basically says, we're not, the after effects of that and other the creation of other technologies like flight, like the automobile, like television, that the internet, the computer and the internet were kind of a dim echo of that. I think that it's certainly a dim echo of the advent of electricity and flight and the automobile. I think the internet's a much bigger deal than television. My main quarrel with Cowen is, I think he has some really interesting descriptions of what has happened in the past, but it's impossible to know. Any one of these trends could change tomorrow. If you look at education, for example, if you compare high school completion rates and college completion rates in the United States compared to other industrialized democracies, one way of looking at that is saying, look at all this low-hanging fruit. These other countries are graduating a much bigger part of their population. With respect to, internet's impact on middle incomes, I think it's just impossible to know. We could be, Davis and Wessel might be right and just sort of late or it's possible that we will never see the kind of payoff. So anyway, I have talked at great length. Sorry, I didn't.
I don't have that much to say about it. I mean, I think that there are a lot of cultural factors in there. I don't really, when people don't graduate from school, I think that a lot of reasons for that. A lot of people can do well without going to school. I mean, school isn't everything. It's what you do with it. An awful lot of people go through college and don't really get anywhere with it. I mean, I'm concerned about a lot of young people today are in such a sort of slough of despair. They get their education, and what did they get for it? They get a lot of debts, and it's kind of tragic for a lot of people. But again, I'm not an economist, so I'm not really in a good position to say anything that useful on that subject.
Well, the college premium, there was a sort of a lot of despair in the late 70s. People were starting actually to think that the actual economic benefit to...
Yeah, well, talk about an article of faith. That's been an article of faith for a long time, that you should spend four or five or six years of your young life when you could be developing a career. You should park yourself over in an institution where tenured professors will be making their money, taking your tuition from you, and then you'll get out hope maybe you'll be able to get a job, maybe you won't. You'll have a huge pile of debt, and then good luck with that. I mean,
well, for better or worse, though, that is the reality of the market. There is a huge divide.
But I'm referring to the article of faith that you're better off going to college.
Right. Well, you are in the sense that you are in the sense that you will probably make more money in the marketplace that exists today. The question is whether the marketplace is responding to colleges as sorting mechanisms. Or indicators that this or that person has it together to
speaking of things that might work better with the internet,
or whether it's actually the education itself.
Speaking of things that might work better with the internet, people may break free of just this old religion of education that you need to go to school and that 4 years of college, you're working your way through the old system and forking and shoveling over huge piles of your money that you don't even have yet. Tenured professor. So, you know, that might not be your best deal. I mean, just taking the money that you would have spent and investing it might be a better way of life, you know.
I agree. And that is actually one point that Cowan does concede, is that the value of the Internet as an educational tool is you know, the potential value would seem to be,
you know, especially
enormous.
If people aren't studying math and science, aren't getting this sort of hard knowledge, people that are going into school and studying, you know, gender studies and literature and film studies and all of this sort of thing. I don't think it's a good investment, and it's very expensive. All these people, speaking of film, this is a good segue to film. All these people that study film studies, they go to film school, and there's like thousands and thousands of people who imagine themselves in this film industry. Are they going to get it? Or are they going to just work as unpaid interns and finally give up and go somewhere else? But meanwhile, you have these, you know, this Hollywood product coming up. Why people who once cared about art would even be interested in getting ground up into such a disgusting machine? I don't even know. I mean, does anyone care? Did you watch the Oscars?
I did watch the Oscars, actually, with my kids. My kids and
did
my
they care?
Teenage
did your
kids.
Kids care about those movies? That doesn't seem to be.
My son is an absolute maniac for the movies. He's seen everything.
How old is he?
He's 17, and you know, wander into my living room, and he's watching. He's watching.
That's what my kids.
Godard movies that I have.
I went through that in my time, and you know, I've also you know, the whole film studies thing. I've been through that, but don't let them go to film school. It's a big scam, and it'll cost you an unbelievable amount of money.
Right.
Just take the money, put it in an account, and let them try to live off the interest in that account. That would be a better economic venture. And, you know, get buy your own digital camera. It costs almost nothing. Go out and make movies, make documentaries. Don't let the film professors take your money. But anyway, so what did he think of the Oscars?
If there were sort of, I'd love to see some studies about, you know, what does happen to kids who, I mean, because the actual number of people employed in the movie business is pretty small.
It's not, look at the total, whatever, billions of, we think it's so important in our cultural life, or it has been at least, that we think it's a big industry, but it's not really that big. They're not really that many. And there are a hell of a lot of people working for free and willing to take jobs at almost no pay that aren't even particularly good jobs just to have a job in the film business. It's really rather pathetic. But,
right. Sort of like you and I are doing right now, in fact, right? How much are you getting paid for this Blogging Heads episode?
Well, that's it. You know, if you do something for love and if you do something for personal expression, it's very different. That's why I say get your own camera, make your own movie, and be completely independent. Go on the internet. Speaking of the internet, do it all on the internet. Make it happen there. Don't let the fusty old professors use you to pad their bank accounts. They're just taking. But what did your son think of the Oscars? Suddenly, I really just want to know what your 17-year-old son thought of the Oscars.
You know, they ended so late that we didn't have a chance to talk about it at great length. He was rooting against the King's Speech, which I think showed rare discernment. The King's Speech, I think, was. I started counting up the number of movies
on the list of
nominees that I thought were better than The King's Speech. And I think I got up as high as like five or six.
Well, why? I don't
And yet it had this sort of aura of inevitability about it. And
yeah, that makes you push against it because you just don't want you want something surprising to happen.
Right. And also, I have to say, I did finally break down and saw the movie a couple weeks ago, and it was fine. You know, I thought it was, yeah.
I used to be very interested in the Oscars, and I will have seen most of the movies, but I haven't seen any of the movies that were up.
You haven't even seen The Social Network? I was rooting for The Social Network.
No, I wanted to see it, but yeah, I just don't. I'd rather be. It's like my point about people trapped in the classroom. I don't want to just go sit in theater for 2 hours. I think
the
our culture
is
makes
very,
us very
is a very
passive.
Well-made,
I don't like
very
the
well-made
restraint.
Movie. It's a very sort of gratifyingly well-made movie. It's. I have some philosophical difficulties with this business of fictionalizing real events and not changing. You know, we used to have this convention in America where if you wanted to make a movie, say, about William Randolph Hearst, you changed his name to Charles Foster Kane, and everybody knew you were talking about William Randolph Hearst, but everybody also knew that you were giving yourself license to change facts, and that's fallen by the wayside. And you are a law professor, so
and
I
it's
have the
yeah
perfect
that's
person
one
to
reason
this.
I resisted it. I knew they presented the legal question in a twisted way to make it more dramatic, and I think it's weird to take something real about a real person and present him in a way that isn't true, and to present at least
Now, if I wrote, let me ask you this as a question of matter of law. If I as a journalist were to write an article that made all the assertions about Mark Zuckerberg in the Social Network, he could and might very well sue me for libel because he would be able to demonstrate that I not only didn't know a lot of the actual facts but didn't care, right? Isn't that the definition of reckless disregard? Yet that's not a vice, that's the actual sort of practice. Aaron Sorkin wrote a very fine script. He actually deserved his Oscar. I thought it was a very well written movie, but it did not adhere to journalistic standards of truthfulness. Yeah. And what I don't get is is there some legal difference that I'm not aware of here?
Well, I think they might have gotten a release from the guy, but if they didn't, they might have felt that they'll just take the risk of letting him sue. And
they didn't get a release. They didn't get a release.
So not get a release.
It's very unflattering. It portrays Zuckerberg very unflatteringly.
Right, I know. So I think that they probably felt like they would just deal with it later. I don't know what their legal advice was, but, you don't have to get a release. You get a release to try to, you're making a decision. That it would be better to be free, to go ahead, say what you have to say, and make your arguments later. I don't know how they plan to do that, how those schemes are done. I mean, I think that'd be kind of an interesting legal practice to think about when you want to release and when you don't. When you want to write about a famous person, well, how are you going to make it a good story if they're hanging over your head telling you how they'd like to be portrayed? Well, it's not even worth doing, probably. So,
right.
Yeah.
I think
better that than, hook them in, act like you're with them. And what's that book by Janet Malcolm, The Journalist and the...
The Journalist Murderer? And the Murderer, yeah.
Is that what it's called? Journalist and... Well, but that's the thing, You're doing something with somebody, you act like you're their friend, they think they're working with them, they believe you're going to portray them in a positive light, and you're really just a betrayer, you're
well, that wasn't the case with this movie. I mean, this movie was based on an unfriendly book.
Right, but I'm just saying that's why you might not want to get it. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that's why you might not want to get a release. You might not want to work with them and make them and take them in. You might want to it might be the more ethical thing to do, to work independently, do what you want to do, say what you want to say, and then be prepared to deal with the consequences.
But there's this third way that used to be the convention, which was changing names. It was a way of saying this is not the literal truth.
Yeah.
This is inspired, obviously, by real.
But you can still get the lawsuit. If everybody knows who it is, you can still get the lawsuit. So, and even if you win the lawsuit,
surely
you
get some
advantage
when through changing names. I mean, you are. Whereas they don't have that defense with. Now I think in the case of the Social Network, I think Zuckerberg just calculated rather intelligently that he had more to lose by making a fuss.
And they may have calculated that into their decision to do it the way they did. And the decision to use the name, they got some PR value. Like, they're getting the PR value that we are talking about on Blogging Ads, that we're, the whole issue of how could they do that is getting people to talk about their movie. So, you know, think that's kind of viral. So you saying Facebook, saying Zuckerman, doing it the way they did, that creates a kind of virality to the, that is PR and word of mouth. At least we're talking about them. And
right.
It's called book face.
Although Facebook probably didn't need the help at that point.
But the movie did. The movie got some viral benefit out of having us do what we're doing now. Talk about how could they do it like that? How could they do that?
Right. It's a really interesting issue. I have a feeling somebody is going to sue one of these days over something like this. It'll be an interesting lawsuit because... Yeah. I think you'd have a hard time establishing a defense that says we do not need to adhere to journalistic standards when you're using real names, right? I mean, professor, but wouldn't that be,
that. There's strong free speech law, especially with respect to public figures. And if people know that it's a fictionalization, have you damaged the person's reputation? You need to prove it. You know, Zuckerberg is so rich. What amount of money is possibly worth suing for him unless he likes to sue for sport? But why would he like to sue for sport? You know, Facebook is about expression and people getting things out there. So he may have why would he want the negative publicity of bringing a lawsuit against a good movie? He's better off going with the flow, so...
Right, and the portrait, in a way, the portrait is perversely flattering. It's, you know, presents him as a prick, but as a really smart prick who did this great thing.
And now people are interested in talking to him about what really happened. You know, the way information spirals around and plays around and cycles around in new media, it's different from the way it used to be. And I'm sure that Zuckerberg is a bit of a genius about how that works. And that whatever strategic decisions he will make in that environment will probably be good ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the old days when William Randolph Hearst was pissed off that Orson Welles made Citizen Kane or whatever. Well, what'd you think of the Oscar show? Did you watch
the Oscar show? I was sort of half paying attention and half writing a piece while I was doing it. But I was very gratified that it was short. It was, as these things go, it was over by about 11:40.
Yeah,
and I
it was short
that
for me
because a triumph.
I used the DVR to just record it, and then I'd go over and watch a little and zip ahead, and I'd be online seeing what happened.
But it's the classic. It is the classic event that you don't want to see even a second after it's over, because it's one of those events. I'm not a sports fan, but people have told me the Super Bowl is the same way.
I'm more high tech than that.
15 seconds after it's over, you don't care.
15
you care while you're watching it, and then you really don't care.
And you kind of already know what's going to happen. And when it's happened, it's sort of like, check, that happened. Natalie Portman won it. Check, Colin Firth. You know.
And you're struggling to remember who won last year, and you don't remember because you don't care. And you think, if I don't care enough to remember, why am I watching it now?
I finally hit the wall on that this year. So, I mean, I'm just interested in doing what I'm doing online and interacting and doing – I have just so much I'm doing on the computer. TV is over there, and I have the DVR working, and I can go and see if, you know, did Christian Bale forget his wife's name or whatever you need to see when it happens. I'm kind of on that level. But then
the cultural events were that Melissa Leo dropped the F-bomb when she won her award, but obviously had it on delay, so they were able to take it out.
They have to do that now. Cher made them do that. Cher and Bono made them do expletive. There's actually a Supreme Court case of that.
Really? Well, it's easy enough to do, right? I mean, I think there's like a 10-second delay or something.
But are you going to do that on every live news event, or maybe just the awards shows ought to do it? You know, you can do it on the Super Bowl.
I think you only need to do it on the ones that, you know, because
you just said if you're 15 seconds late, it doesn't matter anymore. If they put it on a 90-second delay so they can cut it out, then nothing matters anymore.
The other event was that Jennifer Hudson has lost a stupendous amount of weight.
Yeah, we knew that already.
I think we're seconds away from seeing all sorts of online speculation about how she managed to do it. I think her line, she's a spokesman for Weight Watchers now, But Weight Watchers has never had a more astounding spokesperson, because she was very, very heavy. And
so that she looked beautiful.
Great.
A lot of people think she looked beautiful at her heavier weight. She was healthy looking. She was happy and rounded. Why isn't that good? Why are we, you know, do you really want someone that looks emaciated? You know, here's an irony that I'll put out in front of you, this idea about these ultra-thin women, you know, Natalie Portman.
Oh, she's not ultra-thin. She just looks normal now. But what I want to know is, did she do something sneaky?
Oh, like throw up?
No, like, you know, one of those,
that bariatric, yes, surgery. Isn't that disgusting?
It's really disgusting.
I hope not. I don't even want to know that she did. But I mean, this idea that people will achieve their sexual attractiveness by doing painful or self-abnegating things, you know, that are the opposite of pleasure. I think there's this great paradox in our society that we have this idea of attributing sexuality to people who you know, in terms of how things feel to themselves, probably aren't very sexual at all, because they're denying themselves pleasure. They're denying things about their body. I mean, I can't imagine putting breast implants in and affecting the feeling in your own breasts. And,
well, isn't it a matter
of
doing
something
to
your stomach?
Isn't it a matter of choosing your pleasures, right?
But what is your pleasure? Your pleasure is that people are admiring you and not how it feels from the inside. How is it's not, it's the opposite of sexuality.
Well, isn't part of your feeling of sexual power derived from how other people regard you?
That's a type of sexuality, and if that is the sexuality that Hollywood is celebrating, then I think it's right to be horrified by it and to turn away and to turn back into real life and the virtual life of the internet, where you can really live.
Well, I'm more interested in this practical question. How do you lose that? This is, I just can't remember ever seeing anybody lose quite this much weight without being either dreadfully ill or having surgery. She claims not. She claims she did it through diet and exercise, and that she did not do any sort of crash
diet
type stuff.
Smoking is big. How does Barack Obama stay so thin? Smoking.
No, I think it's probably his metabolism, right? Because he's not. Oh, well, is he still smoking? I can't remember.
You see the pictures of him as a child. He was a chubby little boy.
He was?
He's doing. Yeah. And it's in his book. Didn't you read his memoir? He was chubby.
I forgot that. But anyway, getting back to Jennifer Hudson, I think I think inquiring minds want to know, is this, can you really lose that amount of weight without doing
Tim,
anything that is a risk to your health?
Do you really want to know how the celebrities lose weight? I think they get surgery. You know, you can also have great slabs of fat just surgically removed.
Right, but we have to be very careful and say here that she denies it, because we don't want to get sued by
Weight Watchers. Yeah. Well, I didn't. Do you think she really uses Weight Watcher? You know, this actually healthy eating and exercise, that's for the little people. Do you look at these? You know. Did you see the woman? Did you watch the red carpet show with Kelly Osbourne and this other woman who really looked scary thin? Did you see that?
No, I didn't watch the red carpet show.
It was on E!
But when I opened my Washington Post,
I couldn't believe
that
they even put this woman on camera. She looked horrifically ill with this
really?
Skeletal, weird shoulder bones and insectoid skull. You know, it looked really, really bad, and yet it passes for beauty. I just think there's something deranged about the image of women that is being presented by Hollywood. I mean, ever since the surgery and the facial surgery and the breast surgery, all this has become so big in Hollywood. I mean, to me, the actresses look alike. They don't look real. They don't feel real. Just the whole style of makeup and the false hair that they have. What is this stuff that is that is in the position of hair on their heads? It's horrific. It's disgusting. Whatever happened, they look like mannequins. They look false and they don't look healthy and they don't look like they're enjoying life. I mean, why would we want to look at them? I just don't understand the appeal.
Well, as long as we're talking about Oscars, I saw that you had a blog post also inquiring about, you know, whether there were any political statements about Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It was interesting that nobody mentioned. Nobody mentioned union busting in Wisconsin. Nobody mentioned people's yearning to be free in the Middle East. The only political statement I recorded was the guy who directed Inside Job, who grumbled in his speech about the fact that there had been no prosecutions after the 2008 crash. Which I thought, that's pretty small beer for an Oscar ceremony.
Well, you know, and
when the world is going through all these convulsions, especially surprised that nobody mentioned the Middle East events.
Okay, well, a couple of things there. Why aren't there more? Well, just looking at Obama, I mean, why is Obama so circumspect and silent about Egypt and Libya and all this? He said a little something about the Wisconsin struggle, but then he shut up. I mean, there's something is keeping certain typical Democrats who might be expected to speak quiet. I mean, I noticed we had this big march here in Madison on Saturday. There were 70 to 100,000 people marching around the square. And at one corner of the square, there was a stage set up, and that was where the performers were. And the only famous performer was Peter Yarrow. And he went on stage after, who opened for him was a 13-year-old named Samuel Frederick from Wauwatosa, who'd written an anti-Walker protest song. And the not official UW marching band, Tuba and Trumpets, playing things like, If You Want to Be a Badger.
I don't think he wants to get involved in local matters anymore.
Oh, but it's not local.
There's been a lot of grumbling in D.C. that he hasn't gotten involved in the statehood issue, for example.
It has much to do with the fate of the Democratic Party and Obama's connections to the public unions. They're just a huge part of what he's been about and what he has talked about. And he even made some statements.
But that doesn't answer your question. Why is he weighing in in favor of the unions? I think he just thinks
that's what I mean. Yes.
I got enough trouble here. He figures he's got enough trouble right here in Washington, D.C.
The Democratic Party is going to have a lot of trouble, and this is spreading from state to state, and the unions are a big part of the whole structure of the Democratic Party.
The more interesting question you raise is why aren't sort of glamorous Hollywood celebrities? I think that's just part of the long trend where the kind of glitzy liberalism has drifted away from bread and butter issues, economic issues. People, not everybody, but I think most of your Hollywood liberals aren't really, they don't think about, anything that affects the so-called working class. They don't think about income inequality very often. I think they think about the environment.
But they try to be good.
And they don't like guns, but I don't think they're terribly interested in
I don't think their politics issues. Runs deep, but I think when something as conspicuous as this here in Wisconsin is going on, I would have expected at least some political and in entertainment world celebrities, especially musicians, to get involved. I mean, there was a big audience here that they could have showed up for. How come we only had Peter Yarrow? And all this time that we've had the demonstrations in the House, the only politicians that I've seen that have come and walked through and interacted with the protesters were Tammy Baldwin, who is our House representative in Congress, and Jesse Jackson.
Economic justice is not she. It stopped being she for liberals a long time ago.
Part of it
is that they're paid so much money. I think it's a little embarrassing to them personally to think about a lot of these issues because they are so wildly off the charts economically in terms of their own earnings. They don't want to get involved in sort of political causes that will make them feel bad about themselves. Whereas nobody's going to say, how can you talk about global warming when you make...
But wait, they talk about global warming when they have these huge houses and multiple houses and fly around on their private planes. It's only vulnerable on global warming. By the way, I wanted to say that I ran into something that you wrote back, I think it was in 2007, just by chance, yesterday. Mm-hmm. I was writing a post about how come Peter Yarrow was the only a celebrity that showed up at
the Yes, I saw you link to that. Yes,
and,
I did see.
And I went looking for a thing about the story of Peter Yarrow and his troubles with a 14-year-old girl that he got
which,
only
which
a
Which I have never heard before, actually.
And,
that
and
one,
Jimmy
that was
Carter. And then, you know, so he had friends in the Democratic Party. But looking it up, I ran across a review that you did of Robert Shrum's book, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner. In which
that was the, No Excuses was the name of the book.
You did a nice cherry picking out of the Shrum memoir of a time when Shrum relates the campaign's collective sigh of relief when the networks declined to show footage of Kerry at an Iowa party jokingly miming a toque while Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary sang Puff the Magic Dragon. I thought that, you know, to me, well, that's kind of old news, but I hadn't seen that before. But I thought it was really interesting to see one more piece of evidence that the mainstream media is helping out the Democratic Party. They're always helping out Obama. They're always...
Well,
and,
they might
and
have
to
helped,
me,
they might have helped a Republican. I think the mainstream media is, it tends to... that wasn't necessarily ideological. The mainstream media tends to...
You think
to,
if Bush was in a situation where...
Become
he...
intimate with whoever it is they're covering. I'm not sure I would chalk that up to liberal dominance in the media. I think I might chalk it up to the coziness, the inherent and corrupting coziness of beat reporting, particularly by TV folks who I think seem to be worse about this than everybody else. Do you disagree?
Well, I think that the mainstream media is always trying to help out the Democratic Party, and that if the same thing had happened with the Republican candidate, if Bush had been shown pretending to smoke marijuana, we would hear no end about it, just like we heard so much from the mainstream media about any little shred of anything that could be characterized as violent coming from the Tea Party. And all of these signs and ridiculous, violent, over-the-top Hitler type of rhetoric coming from the protesters here, it's just not being covered. It's just not being shown. And it's 1 month after the whole new civility thing that came out of the Tucson massacre, which I always thought was... BS, that, you know, as soon as the Democrats were in a position to start using volatile rhetoric again, they were going to do it. And they were just trying to calm down the Republicans who just won the election. And
have
sure
there,
enough,
have
the
there been
first
public
opportunity,
threats of violence
they're over
against
the top.
Walker? Have there been public threats of violence? I think that's the threshold question.
I think that the Tea Party was constantly talked to, there was a sign that had Hitler on it, a Nancy Pelosi quote was used. There were lots of that somebody might have spit, and that they were saying kill the bill, or of course the people here are saying kill the bill. There was lots of talk about the violent rhetoric. And just last month, in response to the Tucson massacre, there was all this talk about Sarah Palin's PAC having a map that had target marks or crosshairs on districts that they were targeting in the election. And that was portrayed as if it had caused Jared Loeffner, or whoever actually did it, to do the shooting. It was just a ridiculous leap of logic. And yet, and we were all supposed to tone down our rhetoric after that. And now we have this completely over-the-top rhetoric, and the press isn't talking about it. I mean, to me, this is back to the internet.
Well,
that's what
I
the
think
internet
the, I
is
think
for.
There is still an imbalance. I think that my sense is that the conservative rhetoric has been more... Well, two things. It's been more violent, and I think it's also been more racially tinged. Obviously,
absolutely
it can't be racially tinged when you're
not
talking about a white governor versus a look. I went to one of these Tea Party rallies in D.C. and there were I saw without really making much effort, I saw two or three really kind of ghastly. Racially tinged.
The proportion. I mean, I've been to Tea Party, and I've been to these many times. And including a Tea Party rally that was here a couple Saturdays ago. But there is no comparison between the rhetoric of the Tea Party and the rhetoric of these protesters. This is 100 times worse. I mean, you have to look around to find anything amongst the Tea Parties. Maybe, maybe there's some guy with a sign that's over the top. But basically, it's all over the place here.
Well, what about this member of Congress who did not, who had to be sort of prodded into saying that it's not okay to say when are we going to shoot Obama or whatever it was that constituents said.
Oh, that was ridiculous. So are you going to say that every time someone shouts something in the back of a room where a politician is, if the politician doesn't stop what he meant to say and use that opportunity to interact with that person, that then it should be attributed to him, he didn't do enough? I think that that would be terrible for political discourse, because it would mean anytime you do any event, some clown can show up and force you to grind to a halt, that you have to scold that person instead of whatever it was you were going to do, that heckler then gets to determine the content of your speech. That would be terrible. And it would cause hecklers to show up at absolutely everything. It's a terrible dynamic. And just to get one ridiculous Republican congressman, people are willing to make that argument. It's absolutely stupid reasoning that long-term would have a ridiculous effect on political discourse.
Well, apparently it was clearly audible, and he did hear it.
He didn't agree with it.
Violence.
Right, he didn't agree with it, and that person should be shown out of the room. That person should be dealt with. There's no reason, if you're going to say when someone says something in front of you, when is it attributed to you? There's some reasoning to that. Sometimes when someone says something to you and you're silent, you are required to say something to separate yourself from that. But I don't think, I adamantly reject the idea that when someone is having their event and they're speaking, that because someone in the audience has said something, that he now must talk about that. I think
that that person in the audience could say that wouldn't cause you to feel that there was an obligation to respond? What if that person had said, let's exterminate all the Jews?
I think it would depend on the context and how close that person was to you, whether they were on camera, but I don't think a heckler.
So let's shoot the president is okay, but let's exterminate the Jews is not okay.
It's not about the content of the heckled remark. It's about the context of the situation where you have one speaker that people have come to see who has a presentation, who is responsible for the crowd being there. They've come to hear that person. They haven't come to, it's like, don't feed the trolls in the comments section of your blog. You've said something, people are there to read you, there are people who are interacting with you in an appropriate way, and somebody comes in and says one thing, and then does he get to make it all about him? If you're going to say that you absolutely must make it all about the troll, that's just a ridiculous dynamic. That's a terrible thing to say to speakers, that they must stop their planned presentation, their interaction with the people who have come to see them, in order to chide the random heckler who decided to make it all about him. I think that argument should never be made. It's a terrible incentive to all the hecklers and trolls of the world to show up and ruin normal discourse.
Well, I think it's the social norm, actually, both in private conversation and in public.
It depends on the context.
Impetus is actually greater in public appearances. When somebody says something clearly audible that is deeply offensive, I think silence. Look, if you're talking to somebody and somebody says, I think black people shouldn't be allowed to go to the University of Wisconsin,
Tim,
are you going to be quiet and say, no, I wanted to talk about something else?
It depends on the context. If you're talking about a large group with a lecture being given, if somebody starts saying, kill the whatever, they should be escorted out. You should keep silent. First, escorted out of the room. And you wait. You don't, just like when in baseball games, when someone runs onto the field, they don't put the camera on that person. This is a way of trying to discipline the hecklers and the field runners out of the system. And so I think if you're going to say that you're going to punish the politician who doesn't stop and interact with that person, you're setting up a terrible dynamic. And I really suspect that people are only saying this because they're Democrats and they want to help the Democrats, and this guy happened to be a Republican. If the same thing had happened with a Democrat, all the mainstream media people who are always trying to help the Democrats would be making the argument that you hear me making right now, which is a neutral and good argument.
I can only speak for myself, but when Nicholson Baker published a novel a few years ago that was it was a dialogue between two people about whether one of the characters should assassinate George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a piece saying this is, even as fiction, this is not acceptable discourse. This is not. An incitement to violence, even in the context of a novel in which the character ultimately concludes he shouldn't kill George W. Bush. I said, look, this is just not a legitimate topic.
It was published
for debate.
By an elite publisher. Well, who published that book? One of the excellent publishers.
I forget who published it, but I said it was disgraceful. And I have to say, most liberals I know said the same thing. Leon Wieseltier wrote a piece in the New York Times Book Review saying much the same thing. It was not.
There was also a movie about the assassination of. I mean, that just shows how far out.
No. But my point is that it was judged unacceptable. Whereas I don't see a lot of conservatives
after it
rushing
was published
to
by
judge
a,
this.
After it was published by an elite author and an elite publisher, also movie made about assassinating. There was so much discussion of assassinating. And all kinds of violence and all kinds of negativity toward George Bush. Yes, at some point there was some pushback. I agree. And congratulations.
Are we
going to
be hearing from Rush Limbaugh about threats on Obama's life? I'm not going to hold my breath.
I don't think
he will.
I don't think Rush Limbaugh ever says anything at all along the lines of thinking it's nice or good to. I think that if Rush Limbaugh has talked about it, and I do listen to Rush Limbaugh, I think it is just to say, look at the difference in the way that was treated compared to all the talk about assassinating George Bush that we saw. That got
right.
to the point
and the difference
where
between me and Rush Limbaugh is I am a serious participant in political discussion in the United States who is capable of calling foul on my own side. Commits a foul, and Rush Limbaugh, although infinitely more popular and famous than
How often do you listen to Rush Limbaugh? Would you say in a given month, how many hours of Rush Limbaugh do you listen?
Usually, I sort of follow his latest outbursts by logging onto his website rather than listening.
Well, you can join the website and listen to everything. I listen to it all the time. I find it a really good kind of antidote to the mainstream media. I think that's why it's there. But I've never heard him advocating violence, and I just think that.
I'm not saying he advocates violence. I am.
You're thinking he should use
not,
his show to discipline.
He will not cry foul when
he
will.
What he cries foul about
on
is
his
the comparison.
Side, does so. He never cries foul on the activities of Republicans at all. He's a complete party hack.
No, he criticizes Republicans all the time.
He considers the only thing he'll criticize Republicans for is for being insufficiently conservative.
That's right.
That's
he
the
criticizes
only basis
them
for his criticism.
Being principled conservatives.
He is right. Ideologically pure, which I find ideological purity is not something that I.
Well, he's definitely an ideologue. He's putting things into an ideological template, and he's also, I think the best thing that he does is showing how the media puts things into a liberal template. That's why he's the antidote to that. That's why it's important what he's doing. It's because the way the mainstream media is imposing a liberal template on things to an absurd degree,
Well, I don't find him especially credible when he criticizes the liberal media. There have been sort of multiple
uses
the mere
own
fact
words.
That Rush Limbaugh says that the liberal media did this or that is never quite enough for me to.
Now, can I ask you a question
to believe
about
it? I have to sort of see if it's interesting enough. I'll check it out and see whether it's true. And usually, my experience of Limbaugh is you got maybe a 50-50 chance that what he said was actually true. He doesn't have particularly strict standards of.
Well, I would challenge you that those are generalities, and I would challenge you to put out the things that you think are wrong and to make a substantive, specific attack on him because you're saying what is just the standard thing that's always said about him. And I listen to the show all the time, and it's just not true. I think he is pushing back at liberal media. Often the thing he does the best is to take the liberal politicians and liberal media quotes and to play them, to use their own words and then to pick them apart in a very way very similar to a blogger, but way similar to what I would do. Well, look how they said this. Look how the New York Times presented the Wisconsin protesters as having had a victory because they were allowed to sleep overnight in the Capitol once again. You know, I mean, that's what you read the media and you riff on that. I do that as a blogger. And the tendency of the liberal media to do that, I just understand really well. And I think that's the main thing he's talking about. If the liberal media were better, Rush Limbaugh would not be able to be what Rush Limbaugh is. He's fed by that.
Well, we disagree about Rush Limbaugh, and I think that's given the likelihood of our agreeing on that topic is not very great. Perhaps this is it's 1:30. Perhaps this is a good time to
okay.
But this is fun. I loved loved arguing with you. It was a good time.
Okay, cool.
And but don't waste your time watching the Oscars. Their interest value as of today has dwindled down to zero.
I heard there was one guy that said something interesting, but now I forget what it was.
I'll
never find it. Yeah. He had funny hair. The guy with the hair, something.
Funny hair.
Oh, the clip will be on YouTube. You know, if anybody says anything interesting, wait, next day, the funny thing will be on YouTube.
YouTube is a fantastic public service in that regard. You never have to watch television again. Well, except Blogging Heads. You have to watch Blogging Heads, but that's not really television.
But you can make clips out of it. You know, when your thing goes up, you can make a little clip of just the thing you want to put out there and put that up on your blog or whatever. And so, you know, I don't think many people really sit through a whole episode of Blogging Heads. Is anyone still there? We can say anything we want now.
I have no comment on that. But anyway, well, it was great talking to you. Let's do it again.
Okay. Very good. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.